We are in the fourth Sunday of Advent. We are in the home stretch. Christmas is 6 days away. And if you are not ready for that, I will say a prayer for you and a prayer for myself, because I'm not quite ready for that either. But I'm excited. I love this season. And with that, we are wrapping up this series that we have been in as we have been taking a look at the words of Advent, hope and peace and joy so far in this series. And we have been seeing through the eyes of Isaiah how Jesus, as the Word, has come to fulfill all of these words that we have been looking at. And it's not just that he fulfilled them in some kind of abstract way. He became these things for us. Jesus is our hope. He is our peace. He is our joy. And in doing that, he has, as we've seen, some of these words have needed some reframing and redefining, and because how he fulfills them is vastly different than what the world tends to think about these things and how the world tends to define these. And of all of the words that we have looked at so far, I don't think any of the previous three prove that reality more than the last one we're focusing on this morning, love. Now, I'm a child of the 80s, and if you are also a child of the 80s, I know there's a few of us in here, you are either a child of the 80s or an adolescent of the 80s. You will agree, or at least this will resonate with you, that growing up in the 80s, there's a tendency that there's things that we experience that just leave their mark on you. One of the things is my tendency to get really nostalgic and sentimental about middle school and high school dances, because nothing says love like two 13-year-olds dancing in a dark cafeteria. And I don't offer that up without evidence, because if you were, and this might be the loosest use of the term blessed, if you were blessed to grow up in the 80s, and depending on when you were born, you get this on the tail end of the 70s and into the 90s, we were blessed with some of the greatest bad love songs ever. I mean, Air Supply, Chicago. My sister's watching. She's probably wanting to break out the tapes or the albums. Journey, Foreigner. If you don't know what I'm talking about, stay up till about 3 o'clock in the morning and Time Life will tell you all that you want to know. But, I mean, and it wasn't just in the 80s. I mean, you get into the 90s, I guess Whitney Houston was in the 80s, but Mariah Carey, Boys to Men, Richard Marx. I mean, Hold On to the Night. Come on. We were 14 and we were in love. And that love was going to last at least until they turned the lights on in the gym. That's poor 80s kids, man. And they weren't all awful love songs. I mean, there were some really good love songs. And that's not even to mention all of the 80s hair bands that got in on the power ballad thing. And we chuckle about that, and it's silly. It is. But I mean, really, what may not be quite as funny is that in spite of all of the grand promises that those love songs gave us, our culture and our world has kind of gotten a little maybe cynical about love. It's kind of flat and one-dimensional, and you know how our culture frames love. It's the love that we thought was going to last for a lifetime. It's not permanent. It's temporary. And it's, you know, you better get as much out of it as you can before it dies. And so that's how our culture, that's what permeates the framework of how our culture thinks about love. And that's a problem, but it becomes an even bigger problem when we in the church allow that kind of framework to, or maybe not just allow it, but we take that framework and we kind of put it over what would otherwise be a vivid and clear and wonderful picture of what true, amazing love is in the love of God. And if we're not careful, our view of Jesus can become, I hesitate to use the word cynical, but maybe it is. It can become cynical or kind of flat or kind of one-dimensional. And so my hope and my challenge for us, especially in this season, is that we allow ourselves to kind of grow deep in our understanding of who Jesus is. And if we have kind of a flat, one-dimensional picture of Jesus, that in this Advent and Christmas season, we will discover the, as Paul talks about it, the height and the depth and the length and the breadth, of God's love that He has revealed to us in Jesus. You know, the story of this child who was to come that we've been looking at in Isaiah, and the way that love is fulfilled in him is very, very different than the love that we hear about in those really bad 80s and 90s love songs. And so we really need to allow Jesus to be all that He is and reveal to us all that He is in that love. And as I said, we've been journeying through the book of Isaiah, and we'll be in a couple of different places this morning, but at the time that our text was written today in chapter 40, Israel was in a pickle. And they've been in a pickle this entire time that we've been in the book of Isaiah, but it has gone from kosher spears to ghost pepper pickle. It's just the heat has gotten turned up. In fact, it's gotten so bad that the current generation does not want their children to have children. And for the people of Israel, who relied on successive generations, it's gotten bad. They can't fathom subjecting children to the world to how the world is. But listen to how Isaiah 40 starts. And this is another one of those passages that I have a hard time not hearing with orchestral music behind it and some tenor singing. Comfort. Comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Tell her that her sad days are gone and her sins are pardoned. Yes, the Lord has punished her twice over for all her sins. Those first two words of Isaiah 40, comfort, comfort. We've been talking about some of these words we need to redefine. Comfort is actually one of those words that our dictionaries get pretty spot on. Merriam-Webster defines comfort this way: an action taken to ease the grief or trouble of another and to give strength and hope. That is exactly what we see God doing in these verses. Through Isaiah, when He speaks, He is letting the people know that the comfort that they have been crying out for, that they have been longing for, is on its way. It's coming. Their sad days, the hard days, are going to end. There's going to be a new reality. Redemption is drawing near. The Redeemer is drawing near. God Himself is drawing near. Now we can relate to this, because when we see somebody that we love who is in need of comfort, or someone and they're in need of, or they're in pain, it moves us. And it moves us in a particular direction. It moves us toward them, because true love will always move in the direction of the beloved. That's why you can always tell when there's true love. When times get hard, somebody who expresses or says they have true love, they don't get farther away. They will go deeper and deeper in. And that's what we see God doing here. That's what we see Him doing. He doesn't gloss over, He doesn't paint this pretty picture, you know. He doesn't gloss over what has been causing their discomfort. It's their sin. He says, yes, they've been punished twice over for all of their sins. But we see Him moving toward His people who need redemption and rescue and comfort, and He's doing it because He loves them. He's not doing it out of some sort of divine obligation that is disconnected from who they are. He is moving toward them because He loves them. They were oppressed and hopeless, but God lovingly draws near them with a promise of one who will come to ultimately rescue them. That's what Christmas is all about. Jesus came to comfort and to rescue His people because we need redemption. We need redemption from our self-determined lives. We need redemption from our constant attempts to control the world and everyone in it. We need redemption from our constant forgetting of who God is. And Isaiah really helps us out. We've seen this because he doesn't just throw this out there that, you know, there's rescue coming. Good luck finding it. Because over and over and over again, he gives us these pictures of what the redemption is going to look like and who the one bringing it is going to be. Look at what he says later in this chapter in verses 10 and 11. He says, yes, the sovereign Lord is coming in power. He ends verse 9 by saying, your God is coming. He will rule with a powerful arm. See, he brings his reward with him as he comes. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will carry the lambs in his arms, holding them close to his heart. He will gently lead the mother sheep with their young. God himself is coming. And Isaiah gives us, he puts these two images in front of us. He says the Messiah is going to be both a mighty king and a tender shepherd. Now, with the possible exception of David, these are two qualities, especially in the ancient days, ancient times, these were two qualities that you did not find in the same person. You did not have someone who ruled in power and was tender like a shepherd. Gentleness and powerfulness, tenderness and strength, justice and mercy. But we see that in the one who was to come, in this child that Isaiah has talked about over and over and over again. And what he's basically communicating to the people and communicating to us is, in those times that we need rescue, in those times that we need the tenderness and the gentleness of a shepherd, that's how he comes to us. You know, sometimes we wander off like sheep and we need the shepherd to bring us back in lovingly and care for us and to heal our wounds. But he also comes when we need strength and when we need authority. He comes as a mighty king. He comes with a powerful arm. And this baby who was to be born and who was going to be laid in a manger, a feeding trough for animals, he's the one who's going to grow up and be a tender shepherd. He is the one who's going to grow up and be a mighty king. And everything he does and everything about who he is comes from a heart and a nature of holy love. But here's the thing about that love. It's a very different love. It looks different. It sounds different than anything the world has ever seen. And in order to see that love fully, in order to see God's love fully in all its fullness, we need the full picture of who this child, who this person, Jesus, we need a full picture of who He is, who Jesus is in all of His dimensions, in His height and length and depth. And that means seeing Him in a dimension that we don't typically look at Him in this season. See, we reserve this time for little baby Jesus, meek and mild in the manger. And He did come as that. But He didn't come to stay in the manger. And in fact, before He even got out of the manger, His birth caused a stir. In fact, it caused such a stir that it caused one of the kings, who had a tendency to be a bit paranoid to begin with, to flip out and do some pretty awful stuff. His birth caused a stir, both just because of what it signaled and because of what He was ultimately going to accomplish in His love. And just like His birth was something that nobody expected, so was the way He went about accomplishing what He was going to accomplish. And Isaiah, later on in his book, he gives us these four. These two words don't seem like they go together, but it's the best way that I can think of it. He gives us four brutally beautiful pictures called the servant songs. And you can find those in Isaiah 42, Isaiah 40, I wrote these down so I wouldn't forget them, 49, Isaiah 50, and then the one we're going to look at this morning as we close up. And I do mean that. We're going to zip through this. In chapters 52 and 53. And all of these songs, they contain vivid imagery of who this servant would be. But it's that fourth one, the suffering servant, where we really get the full picture of God's love. And this isn't a text we usually read at Advent. It's one that we reserve, and we will probably read it here in just a few months. It's not pleasant, but let's be honest. I mean, really, the whole Christmas story is not sunshine and roses. I mean, you had a girl pregnant under suspicious circumstances, a baby born in a barn and laid in a feeding trough. You had dirty shepherds were some of the first visitors. You had this family having to escape a bloodthirsty king under the cover of night. I mean, when was the last time you really included that in your family Christmas stories? We talk about it, but maybe not. We make it a little bit more pleasant. But we can't divorce the beginning of the story from what the end goal was. Because this baby was not born to just stay in the manger. He came to do something so radical and revolutionary, it actually looked like he was failing when he was pulling it off. And even in Isaiah's description of this, he says it confounded people. They didn't know what to think. They couldn't. And we're going to pick this up in chapter 52. And we're going to read beginning at 52, verse 13, and then through chapter 53. But this is where we find this picture, this full extent of God's love. See, my servant will prosper. He will be highly exalted. But many were amazed when they saw him. His face was so disfigured he seemed hardly human. And from his appearance, one would scarcely know he was a man. and he will startle many nations. Kings will stand speechless in his presence, for they will see what they had not been told. They will understand what they had not heard about. Who has believed our message? To whom has the Lord revealed his powerful arm? My servant grew up in the Lord's presence like a tender green shoot, like a root in dry ground. There was nothing beautiful or majestic about his appearance, nothing to attract us to him. He was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with the deepest grief. We turned our backs on him and looked the other way. He was despised and we did not care. Yet it was our weaknesses he carried. It was our sorrows that weighed him down. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God, a punishment for his own sins. But he was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so we could be whole. He was whipped so we could be healed. All of us, like sheep, have strayed away. We have left God's paths to follow our own. Yet the Lord laid on him the sins of us all. He was oppressed and treated harshly, yet he never said a word. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep is silent before the shearers, he did not open his mouth. Unjustly condemned, he was led away. No one cared that he died without descendants, that his life was cut short in midstream. But he was struck down for the rebellion of my people. He had done no wrong and had never deceived anyone, but he was buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave. But it was the Lord's good plan to crush him and cause him grief. Yet when his life is made an offering for sin, he will have many descendants. He will enjoy a long life, and the Lord's good plan will prosper in his hands. When he sees all that is accomplished by his anguish, he will be satisfied. And because of his experience, my righteous servant will make it possible for many to be counted righteous, for he will bear all their sins. I will give him the honors of a victorious soldier because he exposed himself to death. He was counted among the rebels. He bore the sins of many and interceded for rebels. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. That's an incredible passage of Scripture right there. And I'm not going to comment much on it because it's one of those that kind of leaves you don't know what to say after that. And I kind of want to let it speak for itself, so I encourage you today, tomorrow, Christmas, read this. Keep coming back to this. But I do want to make a couple of comments. First, as you read through these verses, there is a word that is conspicuously absent in the actual text. But when you understand what it's saying, it is all over those words. Love. There isn't a thing going on in this passage that doesn't find its grounding, it's not motivated, it doesn't find its source in the holy love of God for us and for his entire creation. It was a love that was willing to go to the deepest, darkest, a place love had never gone before, to redeem and restore. That's the first thing. The second thing I want to say, this is something that's probably subtle, and maybe something that we don't think a whole lot about when we read or when we think about this, is that we need to be careful that we don't make Jesus into some sort of victim of fate. It's not as if God just needed a sacrifice to satisfy his divine justice, and Jesus just happened to be the sucker. We tend to, whether we realize it or not, and I think it's easy for this to creep in, that we feel sorry. You know, we kind of soothe our own part in this by feeling sorry for Jesus, as if he... Holy Week was not an accident. Jesus was not just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Somewhere in eternity past, there was a conversation within the Trinity. And I know there, if you're a theology snob, you can say, I don't think they talk to each other like this. Well, just use your imagination. But there was a conversation. And they knew that someday they were going to have to do something drastic. Something that had never been done before to restore and reconcile and redeem and remake. And there was no hesitation. As the Son said, I'll do it. I'll go. With words that were dripping with love. That's love. What this child came to do was not just give us a list of good principles to live by. He didn't come so that every day could be a Friday. He didn't come to teach us how to be good little boys and girls. Jesus came to demonstrate God's love for us by doing this. When we were still his enemies. The word rebel is used a few times in that servant scene. When we were still his enemies, he died for us. And in doing that, he forever turned the whole idea of love up to that point on its head. He forever changed the way that we relate and have access to God. He changed forever. He took away forever the two barriers that stood in the way of us and God, sin and death. And only in the genius of God, only in the heart of God, could you describe something so vividly, using language that was so brutal in its description, in a way that showed the love of God so clearly without ever once using the word. There's a reason it doesn't make sense to people who look at it. It's got to be revealed to them from another place. It's got to be revealed to them by the heart of God. And he was utterly victorious in what he accomplished. I love how that starts. It starts with getting it out of the way right at the beginning that my servant, well, he will succeed. And then at the end, it's almost as if God wants to remind us when he sees everything that he has accomplished through his suffering, he's going to be satisfied. You know, he's kind of talking about himself there too. I will be satisfied. I will give him the honor of a soldier who has laid down their life. He is utterly victorious in revealing and showing us the love of God. And he came to earth not just as a baby, he came to earth not just to show us a few good things. Not to just do a few magic tricks like turn water into wine and feed a crowd with a kid's lunch. I mean, he did that, and we see the heart of God in those things that Jesus did. He reveals to us who God is through his actions, but it's through what he would do at the end of his earthly existence. That's what brings us the fullest picture of God's love. And it's through what he suffered and the victory that it brought that we receive access to the hope and the peace and the joy and the love that we all long for. It doesn't look or smell or sound or act like anything anyone would have ever dreamed up, which shouldn't surprise us. Most of the things about who God is and what he does, they don't make sense to us, which is why it needs to be revealed to us from somewhere outside of ourselves. You do realize that when you come to an understanding of God, you didn't arrive there on your own. He has a major hand in that. And it's one of the reasons that it took such a miraculous event like what we celebrate in this season, the coming of this child, to pull it all off. It couldn't be accomplished by normal means. There were things broken and things damaged and things separated that nobody in human history had been able to fix. But this child who was to come, who would ultimately be the one to suffer the punishment for all of that, he did it. And that's what we celebrate. It's not the love of bad 80s love songs, but it's the love of a God who came to earth in the form of a child, to ultimately and willingly lay down his life to fulfill all that God in his love had planned to do. That Jesus is the love of God for us and for all of creation.